Hello, hello, motherfuckers! Welcome back to another episode of Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping. Another extra special quarantine episode with an extra special guest. Say hi, special guest.
Hello, special guest.
Hello, special guest.
I don't have like a cool nickname like you guys do.
Misfit Mike Martinez.
There you go.
You may know him for the guy that... pros. Oh, here's the audio slave.
What's up, guys?
Hello, Marcus.
How's my audio right now?
Oh, man, it sounds awful and muffled.
Does it really? I figured it would.
Yeah, real bad, but we'll work with it.
That's all I got, man.
Yeah, so what are we talking about today, guys?
Probably one of the most influential and talked about rock bands of all time.
I'd say probably one of the pinnacle examples of a band that is... mastered their craft.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And that band is called Rush.
Also known as a trio.
Yeah, a trio. And that's pretty rare in rock music to see a badass trio to that level. You know, because they go against the standard four-piece band setup, and Geddy and Alex and Neil were an absolute powerhouse together.
Yeah, the fact mm-hmm. that much sound could come out of three freaking dudes, incredible.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely insurmountable, cool. Man. Like, insurmountable talent.
And Geddy Lee was responsible for the huge sound for the most part, you know, with all his tricks up his sleeve.
Oh, good mm-hmm. God. Yeah, like, that guy was, like, an octopus.
Yeah, he had an absolute intense ear for his craft.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching a little bit ago today. I was watching just videos of him running, you know, just bass lines, just practicing before a show. And it just blew my mind. I was like, holy shit, man, this guy is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah. He would run bass lines with his left hand on the fretboard while he was playing a fucking synth and then doing shit with his foot. Like, it was insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you got like lead singers who struggle to sing garbage.
Oh, yeah. So. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, I think, and actually, Mike, you and I talked about this previously. And we'll get into the first drummer that Rush had, because he deserves his due. But, you know, Neil Peart, he's probably one of, if not the most talked about drummer in rock and roll history.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? The guy was an absolute monster. Like, when anybody, any drummer, any musician of all time, they're talking about, hey, man, what's your favorite drummer? I don't know about my favorite, but the best one I know is Neil Peart, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you're saying his last name, right? Because everybody fucks it up. It's Peart, not Pert.
Yeah, Peart. Yeah, Peart. And that's not to say what we talked about is that's not to sleep on Alex Lifeson now, because Alex Lifeson, their guitar player, he's an amazing guitar player.
Great. One of the most underrated guitar players. Unless you're like a super Rush nerd, no one really knows how badass that dude was.
Well, because he simmered it down towards the end. Like, I should say towards the middle, when they broke free of the progressive rock era and started going into the synth era.
Right, yeah.
Oh, God, it was terrible.
Yeah, he purposefully toned down his ripping solos. Well,
I'm going to say it was the 80s was terrible, if you saw their videos.
Yeah, they were trying to fit into the niche, I guess, of 80s.
Yeah,
rock,
I understand. But... yeah, they have to, you know, kind of progress along with everybody else.
Well, they grew pretty progressively throughout music history. I mean, this is a band that's been together for 41 years.
Yeah.
40 something years.
One of the longest bands to ever be together.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And so they had to change their sound. You know, how long do you think they'd get far, like how far do you think they'd get in the 80s still pushing out Zeppelin records?
Mm, yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. Like, there had to have been like a following back then for rock. I know there was. I mean,
well, I mean, I'm sure there are, but this is the thing, like, you'll get trapped in that kind of Pearl Jam mindset where you kind of break off from the progression of, you know, what they're listening to on the radio and big industry music, and then you start going into, you know, niche music.
Well, look, you're talking to somebody who loves 80s music. And as far as 80s music goes, if you listen to Rush's songs, they're not that great. I mean,
no.
I mean, as far as 80s music is concerned,
during that era, their music kind of went. That was probably their lowest.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. Like,
yeah,
they're a great band, but the 80s wasn't kind to them.
Well, and I'll tell you why, in my opinion, is because they were out of their element.
Exactly.
They were trying to be something that they're not.
Exactly. Well, Alex Lifeson said he was going to leave the band if it was going to continue on like that. So Geddy Lee was like, okay, I'll put my synthesizers down and you can pick your guitar back up.
Right. Well, I mean, look back to 80s music. If you weren't fucking with a synthesizer, you weren't playing music in the 80s.
Yeah. And I understand where his take was, you know, well, this is my chance to shine on my synth, you know, and it didn't work out as well as he thought it was going to work out.
That guitar oriented shit didn't even start till like the 90s. So they went through years of weird synth crap that was super awkward.
Oh yeah. Well,
but
okay,
honestly,
so
during that time, like, they still came out with some badass songs. Like, you can't lie. Like, they wrote some amazing things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the beginning a little bit. They formed in 68. Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee were schoolmates, right? Geddy Lee vocals, lead vocals obviously, and bass. And keyboards, and Alex Lifeson was guitars, and at the time it was John Rutsey, which was their initial drummer, and he was the drummer on the first self-titled Rush album.
Right.
And he wasn't replaced with Neil Peart until July of 1974, before 2 weeks before the group's first tour of the U.S. So let's talk about a little bit of, I think.
Well, I mean, honestly, it wasn't even Geddy Lee at first. Like, Alex started it with another dude who was.
Right.
Jeff Jones, I think was his name. Like, no one knows about. Yeah, it was,
I don't think he was in it for long enough to be important.
Yeah, I think it says like a couple of fucking weeks.
Yeah, for a historian, like a Rush historian standpoint, sure, an honorable mention, but I don't feel like he was, you know, impactful enough to be considered Rush. He just jammed with Alex Lifeson for a little while. You know. So Rush as a whole, they started off in 68. We'll talk about some of their main influences. And you can hear that in Geddy's high-pitched yells and his the way he sings. It's very Led Zeppelin-esque. Yeah. Right?
Very Jewish. Yeah.
What's that?
Very Jewish.
So were they
very Jewish?
So were they the Greta Van Fleet of their day?
The Greta Van Fleet of their day. Right. No, I mean, they did. They, I mean, Led Zeppelin was a huge influence on them, and you can hear that even with all like the fantasy and kind of science fiction in their lyrics. Right. That's in a lot of their lyrics.
Story,
you know?
Yeah,
they definitely were.
Exactly.
And they were kind of the first of their kind. Well, I mean, they probably saw that Led Zeppelin did a lot of that kind of stuff, and that's maybe where they got a little bit of inspiration. But I mean, they were around in 68, so I mean, they were all kind of grooving on the same. Years, you know.
Yeah, but like Led Zeppelin didn't like their like for Rush, like their whole album was kind of a story, and it, from start to begin, like start to ending. But like, you know, Led Zeppelin didn't really do that much at that time.
Well, no. Like Led Zeppelin was a stadium rock band, but like I'm just saying, like the motive of their lyrics and the driving force behind their creativity was very Led Zeppelin-esque. They were, because Led Zeppelin was storytellers, but look at the. You know, the members that they had in their band, they were all powerhouse musicians and wanted to sell 2 million records.
True.
You know what I mean? Rush was just, like we talked about offline, they were just a bunch of nerdy kids jamming together that happened to be fantastic at their craft.
Yeah,
they became that way. They became the stadium band later on, though.
They did, eventually.
I don't think they ever had any intention of being what they became.
Oh, never.
No.
Never at all. They just
They were overnight success, pretty much.
Yeah,
and like even with their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, they were so humble about it. They're like, whatever.
that's because they're cool, down to earth dudes, yeah. Man. They're not, you know, like self absorbed rock stars like, you know, Mick Jagger. You know.
Yeah. Well, also I think it's notable to mention, like when they first started playing, it was very difficult for them in Canada because they were young kids. They were 16, 17, 18 years old, and they were having to play like these school halls and little concert halls wherever they could get a gig because they couldn't play bars.
Yeah, that type of music wasn't very big in Canada at that time. It was very very experimental. They weren't used to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And their first single was not Fade Away. It was a Buddy Holly song that came out in 73. So that kind of started getting the gears moving with them a little bit. And then they formed their own independent record label, Moon Records. So that kind of started picking things up a little bit as well. What's that?
I was going to say, I think that their original drummer, the Jod Rutsey, he got a pretty raw deal.
Yeah. I would think so.
Yeah.
He left on his own accord, though, according to.
That's not what I saw on one of the movies I was watching. He was pretty much told by the producer or the
he kind of got pushed out, right?
Their tour manager. Yeah, he was kind of like, sorry, man, you have diabetes, so if you continue to drink with these guys, you're gonna die. So we need to find a new drummer.
And I think it was a hey, would you rather quit or would you want me to fire you type scenario?
Exactly. Either do it now, you know, do it now and get it over with so we can just move on, please.
And
right, because after their self-titled album, you know, dropped in 74, they knew, their record label knew that they were getting ready to take off, and they knew that Jon Rutsey couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
And he, and I mean, not to put him down, like, but he was nowhere near the caliber. So everything happens for a reason, and damn, did it not turn out great for them.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it definitely happened for a reason.
Like,
for
Jesus
sure.
Christ, man. Like, I feel sorry for him and all that, but not really.
Yeah, I feel bad for about 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, they received a drumming god in his exchange.
And you know, like, honestly, from a drummer standpoint, when they first started, he wasn't that good. Like, Neil Peart was like one of those dudes who wanted to get better at his craft. And if you really followed him, like, their first album, he was okay. He did some normal stuff because, like, his inspirations were John Bonham and whatnot. So you can kind of hear that. But he didn't do
Keith
Moon. He didn't do any of the crazy shit that you hear him do now.
Well,
he like
yeah, but
grew.
Well, back in those days, though, nobody was doing the crazy shit yet. I mean, and that, you know, according to Geddy Lee was like, man, the first time I saw Neil perform, you know, for us to audition, he was like, sold. I want
exactly. And like, you, if you followed them like throughout their good God, how long journey that they had, like, you could like see Neil grow and grow, because that dude just learned. He was like a powerhouse. He was,
Well, think about it in the sense of like most other bands that you see that are already semi-successful musicians and they substitute a member. It always takes that new member at least an album, you know, to pick up their creativity, right, and pick up their flow and see where they fit in with the band dynamic. Like, look at Eddie Vedder when they first formed Pearl Jam. He was just some surfer guy working at a fucking gas station. And look at Robert Plant. He was in the room with, you know, absolutely successful musicians. You know, Jimmy Page just came out of the Yardbirds. It took him an album. It took him Led Zeppelin I to find his footing. You know, and I think that was the same thing with Neil Peart. Like, he just took an album to step back. Cause, you know, he wasn't going to come in there swinging his dick around and be like, all right, thanks for, you know, letting me in the band. I'm going to start writing your songs now.
They were babies. They were kids, yeah. When, you know.
Right, but they were very dedicated and they already had an album.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean? Like, I think in the sense of age, yes, they were kids, but in the sense of musicianship, they've already surpassed my 30-year-old ass when they were 16 years old.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? So I think it was a little bit of that. And plus, you know, he was gearing up. Look at their first tour. They were fucking opening for, you know, Manfred Mann and Uriah Heep in front of 11,000 people.
That was his first gig. That was
his first gig.
Yeah, that's yeah. Going from zero to that. So, wow.
Yeah, that'd be nuts. That's going from, you know, playing in your dad's garage, because that's literally what he did. He was working at his dad's, you know, shop. Mm-hmm. I think it was an auto parts store, and then he, you know, joined Rush.
Yeah,
and went on to play with Uriah Heep, which was huge in 68.
Yeah.
Uriah Heep was a very big name by that time. Anyway,
kind of a weird mix, though, to have Rush open up for those guys.
I don't know if it was at the time, because I don't feel like the music industry or they had established, especially in the United States, because that was their first.
No
US
one really cared if it. Yeah.
Nobody knew who they were.
Yeah, they were just like, okay, bring Uriah Heep on.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, you know, when Nirvana would open up for Alice in Chains. Nobody knew who Nirvana was at the time,
mm-hmm.
with Bleach out, you know, and then got, lo and behold, you've got one that's, you know, surpasses it. But since the very beginning, you know, the focus, the one thing that I absolutely adore about Rush is, even though they followed out with the musical periods, you know, throughout time, we're talking about the synth rock, the progressive mm-hmm. rock era, you know, things like that, they all always focused primarily on their instrumental aspects.
Oh yeah. They're super long and like intros, or their, you know, what their songs went on forever. Their best songs did anyways.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely fantastic. They're, you know, when they started finding their, you know, because they went from those Led Zeppelin roots, you know, Led Zeppelin got their toes in the water, but their real roots and their real focus are bands, you know, like the progressive rock bands. We're talking like King Crimson, Genesis, Yes, shit like that. Like, if you listen to their first three or four albums, you're going to hear Yes, a mixture of Yes, Genesis, and mm-hmm. King Crimson. You know what I mean? Like Fly By Night, for example, that came out in February of 75 with Mercury Records. Look at the singles on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole side two, the whole side one, for that matter, is a chronological story, which is so, so progressive rock. It hurts.
True. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a progressive rock fucking anthem.
And I think that's what kind of like maybe hurt them in a way, is like they were so progressive, and what I guess you would call it an acquired taste at that time.
I think it put them in a box.
They were kind of pigeonholed into the stoner rock group, to where
the jam band,
the whole jam band thing, which I don't really think that's what they were trying to do, but that's what they kind of got put there, like. You know, you go home and you get stoned and you throw your headphones on, but they weren't like in with the big arena bands or anything. So they kind of got pushed to the side, because
mm-hmm.
those type of people that listen to that music were also pushed to the side. Like, they weren't, like, during that time frame, everybody was listening to the big arena bands. So.
Right.
Yeah. But they were just another up and coming band, you know, and then once they became known, they were, you know, the band that nerds liked.
Well, and that's exactly what they were, and that was the target. Yeah. That's the target audience that they wanted to hit, because
it's an untapped resource that nobody's, you know, kind of tapped into yet.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, if you look at, even more so, you can see them growing even further into the progressive rock stuff with their third studio album, Caress of Steel. You know, it's a five track album.
Yeah.
Right? And the entire front album is progressive rock to the threshold. Their number four song, The Necromancer, that's split into three different parts: Into the Darkness, Under the Shadow, Return of the Prince. Like, that's all one consecutive story. That's very Led Zeppelin meets progressive rock, you know, the aspects of science fiction and fantasy and things of that nature. And then the entire side two is a 20-minute song. Like, what? God damn,
well, what do they think is going to happen if you put a 20-minute song on your album? You're going to be prog rock for life.
You're going to be fucking Pink Floyd Echoes.
Exactly.
Is what you're going to be. Prog rock for fucking days.
You're talking
about
Caress of Steel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even when you look at the song titles, it's all, you know, Dungeons and Dragons esque fantasy shit.
Yeah.
Thing, so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at the guys though. Like, look at Geddy Lee and look at Alex.
No, well, I think Alex kind of looked normal, and then Geddy Lee and Neil kind of were the ones that kind of looked
weird. Like, during that time though, they dressed the part.
That's funny. Oh yeah.
How about that one period where all they wore was the oriental silk, you know,
gowns. Like the kimonos with all the glitter.
Yeah. Exactly.
Dude, I love it so much. And then the very next album, their fourth studio album, 2112, is the same thing. Yeah, great album, but 20-minute song, side one, fantastic, but get your beanbags ready and fucking pull up, folks. You know, like, but that was also, you know, that was their first real commercial success.
And there was a lot of bands doing it, though. I mean, everybody was going down to their basement, like that 70s show, getting high and putting on a record, and then just chilling for like an hour and a half, listening to the instrumentals and getting lost in them. And so that's who they wanted to emulate, I guess. Or
yeah. Well, I mean, that's what was selling in the United States. Yeah. Because it was like, at that time, it was the British music invasion at that time. And you had Pink Floyd taking over the rock and roll circuit because, you know, Zeppelin started semi-fizzling out by that point. I think Houses of Holy was, you know, was coming out around there. But you know, in the late 70s, the mid to late 70s, that's when that shit started coming out. And that shit eventually gave birth to synth rock, which they fell into as well. You know, with, you know, Farewell to Kings, Hemispheres, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's only natural with Getty's, you know, keyboard skills. Yeah.
So as a drummer, Mike, I want to take a little segue from the That's the history great. Lesson. As a drummer, what's
a segue?
What's that? Yeah, segue. As a drummer, what sort of influences does Neil have on your playing style? Like, what do you I don't know, you know, dick all about drumming, other than hey, I follow you, you know, but I want what sort of stuff is he bringing to the table for drummers? Like what, I know it's gotta be an insurmountable amount of information to follow, but what's he bringing to the table?
It's crazy
for you guys?
Because like, there's no way that I could really explain it. Cause that dude was in his own element. A lot of his inspirations are the same ones that I have, like, you know, Keith Moon, shit. There's so many different ones, very rudimental drummers, like not so much into crazy, you know, flamboyancy or whatever, but like super refined and like focused on all his fills and all that kind of shit. Like, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but but like,
yeah,
like Buddy Rich, he was super close to the Buddy Rich family. I don't know if you know who Buddy Rich is, but that dude was
probably
one of the greatest jazz drummers of all time. Like, it's insane. That guy did things that no one had ever seen before in that time. So he blew everybody away.
And he basically didn't he show Neil how to play? I mean, a second time around, per se?
He did a lot with his daughter. He was invited by his daughter to do some memorial stuff. I think I'm not sure if he actually played with him or not, but
well, I forget who it was in the documentary I just watched that came out several years ago. I think it was him, and he basically, you know, gave him a redirection in how drumming should his particular drumming should go, and like loosen him up, kind of. I guess you could say, like, remember Mike?
I think you're talking about Freddie Gruber. Gruber was also like one of the 90s badass jazz drummers.
That's exactly
so,
what
like,
it is. Yeah.
Before, he was doing like that prog rock, weird experimental drumming shit. And then you could tell like in the late 90s, 2000s, he got into some more jazzy, very cleaned up stuff. Like all his drum solos were like perfected and very like organized. I don't know. Because his drum solos were badass. They were one of a kind. But if you see other really amazing drummers drum solos, like they'll go all over the place and go nuts. And everybody's like, "Ooh, that's badass." But it's not organized.
It's not articulated.
Right, yeah, it's fucking messy. Like to the
right.
Well, there's a lot of drummers, because I've gotten in this debate with people a couple times, because there's a lot of drummers that are faster.
You can be fast as hell, but
than Neil. Well, shit, Joey Jordison, the former, you know, drummer for Slipknot, he was faster. But as far as, like you said, put togetherness, technicality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And unpredictability. Neil's going to take it every time.
I mean, his solos kind of told a story, so you could, like, follow it. And he, like, went through history and stuff like that. Like, it wasn't just a mixed mash of a bunch of cool shit, like, ooh and ah, but
yeah. Wasn't just a bunch of random drum transitions put together.
Like going through, like, if you really follow him, he was kind of hesitant at first about putting electronic drums in his set at first. He was one of the first people to bring that into the forefront. And, like, he brought in, like, I think it was Simmons drums back in their early days. Mm-hmm. Like, Simmons was, you know.
They had those big pads.
Huge. Like that, but that was like what it was at the time. Like it was a new thing to have electronic drums, and like, and he brought that in there and integrated it so well. Like he didn't, it wasn't gaudy, you know. Like,
well, during that time as well, all the other members of the band, you know, Alex and Geddy, they were doing their experimental thing too. You know, Geddy started playing with the synthesizer stuff. He started being real prominent with the synthesizer lines, as well as Alex Lifeson. He brought a lot of the steel guitar and 12 string into there during that time. So there was all it, like the late 70s, early 80s was a very experimental time for Rush. You know, with their fifth and sixth studio albums, you know, Farewell to King and Hemispheres, that was kind of the end of the prog rock era for them and the transition into the experimental synth rock. They're like, okay, well, we've done this, we've done that. Let's try something else. You know, though, I love it, but there's only so much I can listen to. You know, and if I'm going for a good prog rock album, I'm turning to King Crimson.
Moving forward, blah blah blah, that time machine, Moving Pictures.
Yeah.
Moving Pictures was the breakthrough album for these guys. Like, dude, it had the fucking dad air drum solo of the fucking world on there. Tom Sawyer, like Red Bachelorette, YYZ, Limelight, like.
Yeah, just so many good songs.
That album was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I think Permanent Waves was my favorite. That was, to me, that was kind of their breakthrough album. I guess it's subjective.
It was right before it, so you could tell that they were, because you got Spirit of Radio, Free Will.
Spirit of Radio, Free Will, like that to me, like the first two songs in the album, like holy shit, and the first two songs on a Rush album that are under fucking 15 minutes.
If you were to buy that album not knowing, and then you just throw on in the first song Spirit of Radio, it'd blow you away. That song is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, and that Permanent Waves, that album was the first one to bring them to the top five in the U.S. You know, and that's pretty fucking sweet. That was their breakthrough work, you know. And they actually had help writing Tom Sawyer. Max Webster, the lyricist of Pie de Bois, actually helped write that song, offered a good bit of lyrics on that. And Neil Peart rewrote it, which I thought was interesting.
Do you know that Blender magazine isn't that reputable of a source, but they named him one of the worst lyricists of all time? Yeah, it was weird.
Really?
I can't tell you.
Why?
I'm going to look it up real quick, but I read it earlier today. No, Neil Peart.
Geddy?
Because, you know, he wrote a lot of their songs.
Oh, Neil.
So he was like one of the worst lyricists.
That's kind of a dickhead.
Actually, he was number two on their list of 40 worst lyricists in rock.
Yeah, stupid.
Who's number one?
Are you fucking kidding me, though? Like,
fucking please.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you look at like when Blender started and blah blah blah, not to bash them, whatever. But
if you look at stuff like Desert Rose, I mean, come on.
I don't really consider Blender as one of the top info sources.
Yeah, I wouldn't move with that either. Also, that's something interesting, I think, when you were talking about Moving Pictures, which came out February 12th, 1981 with Anthem Records. God, they were some record company bitches. They were cruising, man.
They went where the money
went. Very smart.
Yeah. So they snuck in a little bit of that prog rock anthem stuff on the side two of that album. The Camera Eye, an 11-minute song with two parts. Damn it. Damn it, Geddy. I know that was him, too. I just know it. And he was rolling synthesizers really hard in that album as well. Definitely. They're in the height of that at this point. But, I mean, Moving Pictures, that bumped them up to a number three slot.
Well, they were about to give up, man. And before Moving Pictures launched them again, they were just like, I guess this is, you know, we're going to make one last album. And if it doesn't, you know, take off, then we just made something that we wanted to make.
That's what I was saying. That kind of put them in the, you know, the forefront. Tom Sawyer was a huge hit.
Would you say it put them... Would you say it put them in the limelight?
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, so, I mean, it worked out well for them. Moving Pictures worked out well for them. I think all of their albums were not a complete flop, but, you know, Signals, Grace Under Pressure. This is kind of in the experimental years, like we talked mm-hmm. about. This was kind of the back and forth release album tour, release album tour, release album tour. And this is another interesting point about Rush is I have never, you know, because obviously with this podcast and being music fanatics, you know, we do a lot of research on bands. We do a lot of research on the motive of bands, the life of these bands, to try to get into the history of these, to, you know, these guys and gals, to articulate their lives and see where they're coming from. But Rush was a very clean-cut band.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think I know off the top of my head, aside from maybe some classical composers and maybe some jazz musicians, not even that, that were so dedicated to their instrumentals and mastering their craft.
I think because they truly enjoyed it. I mean, that's who they were, you know, that was their base of their soul.
Yeah. They never really got sucked into the media hype. You never heard anything about them really, except how good they were.
Any trash talk about them.
The only thing was positive. No. It was like, damn. All right.
Yeah. You know, like, yeah, like we were talking about offline, like when they were on tour with Kiss, that was one of their breakout tours. You know, they had like this woman's symposium thing staying in their hotel, and there was just chicks in their bathrobes walking around the hotel drinking beer, and, you know, Gene and Paul and them, they're fucking partying with them, and Getty and Alex and Neil, they're just in there in the hotel room being quiet, watching TV, you know, hanging out.
Yeah,
that's just crazy to me. Like, you don't see that very often. You don't see a band that's completely dedicated to one single solitary thing, except for maybe John Paul Jones. Like, maybe you can.
I think that they were just good guys, man, because they all had wives down during that time.
They were super dedicated
too.
To not just their music, but their personal life.
Their family. Yeah, they were private people, and then they wanted to keep their private life private.
Yeah. Very fucking rare. I
completely agree. Okay, so move. Yeah,
which
yeah,
I think
very
also
rare.
Contributed,
you know what I mean?
To how successful they got. Like, I mean, if they would have gotten sucked into that bullshit, then I don't, you know, they might not be where they are.
I don't know if it attributes to how successful, quote unquote, in the standard of like Billboard charts. To me, anyway, you know, this is all subjective. But I think it attributed to how respected Rush is.
No one ever has as a bad word to say about them. Like, people respect them as a group, like, a lot. Everybody was so,
and
like,
how could you not?
Heard about why haven't they been inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yet? What's taking so long? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. It took a while. Like, 2013.
When did they get inducted?
I think was finally when they got inducted.
Really?
It took that long. So
they take a long time.
Yeah, I don't really want to talk about that. The whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing is a whole nother story, but
yeah.
I think that's all a fucking
gets a little
that's
too
all a boys
monetarily
club.
Political, if that's the right way to put it.
Oh yeah, that
What's the benefits of being inducted into the Rock and Roll
thing.
Hall of Fame? Just
you get your name engraved on some cool glass, I guess.
Who gives a shit?
It's because that recognizes that you as an artist that, you know, is going to be legendary for years, you know, eons to come.
I think Rush will be pretty legendary for eons.
They were before they were ever inducted. So.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a few different records that came out, you know, in the 80s. We talked about this, a little bit of a dark era, but it still kept them moving. Grace Under Pressure, released in 84, you know, Power Windows in 85, Hold Your Fire 87, and Presto in 89. All great records, and they were turning them out, weren't they? Holy
turned them out, eh?
Burned them out, eh? And they were on the fucking Trailer Park Boys.
Oh, they were. Well, Lifeson was.
Well, Alex was. Yeah, Alex was. But see, back in 89, when Presto got released, Alex was significantly more guitar centric than those previous albums.
Yeah.
I did notice that. And he was very much more guitar heavy because, you know, got to remember, as we were talking about in the 80s, they were very synth heavy.
Well, they discussed that. I mean, they were pretty much, he was pretty much like, this is it, man. I don't want to hear synths anymore. I want to bring my guitars back. If you don't like it, then we need to talk. And so pretty much the, you know, what's his nuts was like, yeah, I'm with you, man. Let's just go ahead and do your guitar thing.
That was like around 89, 90. You could tell the change.
The end of the 80s.
Solos were getting in there. Like, he was killing it.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the notoriety of Getty and Neil started kind of overpowering his, you know, his musical, not, I wouldn't say his musical ability or musical anything, his creativity. It started stifling his creativity a little bit. You know what I mean? Because with Getty, his overbearing voice, you know, already is commanding in and of itself, you know, not to mention he's a great keyboard player and he's a fucking phenomenal bass player. And we don't need to talk about Neil. Everybody knows about Neil. But I think Alex started feeling a little bit almost pushed to the wayside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and so he wanted a little bit more, you know, because like you said in the beginning, he's probably one of the most underrated guitar players of all time. And I think Presto really, Presto and Roll the Bones, I think those two albums really brought out his, you know, guitar playing mantras, you know, if you will, you know, his
skill prime
as a guitar player. Yeah, his prime, because, I mean, he is a very fantastic guitar player. And so they continued through the 90s with Counterparts in 93 and Test for Echo in 96, both a collaboration album with Peter Collins. After these albums, though, it's kind of shitty what happened to Neil. Did you guys read what happened to Neil during that time?
Yeah, he lost his wife and his kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of his documentary that he had. Pretty moving stuff, man. Like,
was it?
Yeah.
It's.
Yeah, he just got on his motorcycle and just rode.
And the fact that he videotaped the whole thing was pretty phenomenal. Like, he wanted to document it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they entered a 5-year hiatus after this, which is, God, I think they fucking deserve it. Like we talked about, these guys were some record pumping sons of bitches. They didn't take a break for nothing.
No, I think like between tours, they would maybe take 6 months to a year if that was it. If that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And while writing music on tour,
probably just like 3 to 4 months, I would think.
Yeah. And then, Neil ended up remarrying, Carrie Nuttall or whatever her name is, Nuttall. I like to call her Nuttall.
Go back, that documentary is called A Work in Progress.
A Work in Progress.
Hmm.
I like it. And he also wrote a book called Ghost Rider, Travels on the Healing Road. I like that too. I might have to read that.
Is it about him taking peyote out in the desert?
I hope so. I really hope so. I was going to say, I really need to read that, but I don't know how to read it. That's going to make that really awkward.
Yeah, the work in progress is kind of dry.
Just
not like super into drumming, but it's you know, it's for the Test for Echo album. And then he like drives around on his motorcycle and talks about shit. But then he kind of like gets into his fundamentals. And if you really pay attention, like he teaches you a lot of his, you know, drumming skills. Like, it's pretty badass, but kind of boring at sometimes if you're not that into it. So
I mean, I'm into drumming.
You might,
I'm into Neil's
like
drumming.
You might not.
So when they finally came back together, that's kind of when Neil got his idea to have his little drum cage kit.
What do you mean when they come back together?
Was that it?
After he, you know, after his motorcycle thing and
Well, they went on a
he got remarried, and then he says, "Okay, it's time. You know, we're gonna do this again, guys." You know, that's when his drum cage came into play. It wasn't
not
before
really.
That, was
I mean,
it?
He always had a pretty eclectic set, like he.
But nothing to the extent
like,
of that.
But he was always like putting bells and like marimbas and like weird shit that most people weren't putting into their drum kits at the time. And he was basically like flawlessly putting those into the songs. Like it was pretty badass. Like he was one of the, you know, forefront guys on that, adding different instruments for like percussive instruments into it anyways.
I think him and Nick Mason did that a lot. I don't think Nick was in the same.
Oh, please.
You know,
Nick Mason. What did he have? He had like a little, what do they call? No, gong. Not the gong. Well, yeah, he had one of those too, probably. No.
Well, I mean, he
what are those little bells? They're like little,
triangle,
kind of like a triangle. Yeah, kind of
tambourine.
No, they're like little,
they're called chimes.
Chimes. That's right.
Yeah, they're called. Oh, they're chimes. Chimes.
That's all he had was a little bit of chimes behind him, and a gong.
Ah, Nick, man, Nick had a very eclectic way and a very cool way of drumming.
Oh yeah, I agree. You know that for anybody to say it's me, but Neil's Cage was ridiculous.
Oh yeah,
and it kept changing. The
motherfucker was an absolute monster.
Every tour they went on,
bigger and bigger.
I mean, I could go on for days talking about his shit. Like that dude, like in his set, would hit a thing, a trigger, and the whole drum cage would spin, and he would turn around and start playing a different side of it. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah. Tom would like to play upside down.
Tommy Lee was a fucking shit ass.
Tommy Lee
can
keep
beat.
He had his own thing. I'm not gonna knock him because he's a pretty awesome drummer in his own right, but. He's not on the same caliber.
I don't know, man. I saw
no.
I saw Motley back in like 2014, well, and they were pretty bad.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, Nikki even rock podcast. Nikki Six really knock bands, but Motley kind of sucks.
Oh,
you can absolutely.
Say Motley, I'm a virgin on here, so fuck Motley Crue. They suck. I cannot understand. I cannot fathom why they are famous and popular as they are, but it was before my time. It was before my time, so it is what it is.
It was 80s rock.
I think it was more so
lack of.
I think it was more so the
everybody
atmosphere.
Settled on that.
Mick Mars, yeah. his guitar tone was like the worst.
The Walking
the
Dead.
Worst guitar tone ever.
Whatever, they did something right. Well.
Hey, they had sex and that's what it was.
They
about.
Were all they exactly. They were appealing to the devil worshippers, and
but I mean, their lyrics weren't even like devil worship.
I don't know, man.
But shout out to Devil, man. It was like everybody bought that album because it had a freaking pentagram.
Their lyrics now, I compare it to the bullshit hip hop lyrics now. It's just mumble. It's whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that.
Well, that's for a different show.
I just, but I agree with you because I'm primarily a blues and classic rock guy with a little bit of punk undertones. But like, I look at bands like that, like Motley Crue, and I'm like, what in the fuck? Like when you compare those bands, like shit, like Bruce Springsteen to me is the worst musician
but he has
that's
like
ever
a huge
fucking hit the stage
it's crazy.
Ever. Period.
Yep, it's a different.
I don't
a different
understand
time, though, man.
It.
Like, we won't get it.
He sounds like if I went and paid a bum 75 cents to go, we were born to run. That's what he sounds like to me. He sounds like a dirty.
But that's why he's popular.
Person.
His voice is different. It's not like just like Geddy Lee. Sometimes I'm saying Geddy Lee.
Dude,
his
I
voice
love
is
Rush.
Irritating
They're
as shit
one
to
of
me.
My most favorite bands. I agree. Sometimes his voice just drives me nuts. There's some songs where I'm like, God, dude.
Yeah.
But like I said, they're one of my favorite bands. So, yeah, it is give or take, I guess.
I think it's just like we keep talking about. I think it's that the simple fact that they're masters of their craft. Yeah. You know, where do we leave off?
I think they started getting really progressive and changing their sound to, I guess, match, the times. You could really tell like what was going on.
Yeah.
And they did a good job. That's the thing. Like, people kept following them. Like, they didn't lose fans. What was it? We're going to move through some years. Blah, 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 blah. Counterparts. Like, that's when they started rolling into some.
Oh, yeah, shit. Yeah.
Like, trying to. I mean, it was the early 90s. So they were trying new things.
Yeah.
I agree.
They were getting back to their roots at that point.
I think they're finally backtracking. Because they people wanted that old school sound.
Exactly.
Right. They've got their success at this point. By the time Counterparts came out in 93, like, they had gotten their success, their commercial success. They had got their following. And their entire play, because like we talked about, is they're from Ontario, Canada. And one of the most difficult feats getting into the U.S.
Was their 15th studio album. That's fucking nuts.
That's a lot of music to remember.
15th studio album.
Being a prog band like they are, you know how hard that would be to remember every note to every song, the length of the songs on each album. I mean, it's just ridiculous how
their memories can handle that.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah. And all their albums were intense. You know, Test for Echoes, like we talked about, even moving into the early 2000s with Vapor Trails and Snakes and Arrows in the mid-2000s. They were all great albums. I don't think Rush ever
liked some of the songs that were on there, but they weren't terrible.
They weren't bad albums, and I think, like I said, by the time the early 2000s hit, they were pushing towards audience.
Yeah.
They've already, you know what I mean? Because
they're selling out everywhere in the whole world at that point.
Yeah, exactly. They don't give a shit. They're just doing their things. So, so we've got Snakes and Arrows in 07. They're still with Anthem Records. Yeah. That's a pretty good record.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good one. It was decent.
Weird. People weren't, well, Vapor Trails did that first. When Vapor Trails came out, people were like, okay, you guys are kind of trying, something different, but it wasn't that popular at all.
Yeah. Well, Secret Touch and Earthshine, those were good albums. I mean, those were good songs on the record on Vapor Trails.
Well, every album is going to have two or three good songs, and the rest is just filler.
I mean, when you're a band of that caliber.
Yeah.
And you're trying to think of new shit. It's like, we have, how many albums have we put out? This many. Holy shit. We have nothing left on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. In Clockwork Angels, that was their last studio album that they put out. That was their 19th studio album. It's
too bad they couldn't have made it to 20.
Yeah. Just an even number.
That's how I am.
Yeah. They released, Clockwork Angels, 12 June 2012, still with Anthem Records. Hey, another decent album from Rush. They're not killing it at this point because, they've already made their money. They're just making some jams to keep their, to keep their careers going
Most of the time, you have to have a tour to have an album to go on tour. You know what I'm saying? So like, if they're going to go on tour next summer, we got to put another album out for next summer, So I mean, bands nowadays, they don't even give a shit anymore. Like, let's go back to Motley Crue, for example, that they just go on tour when we feel like going on tour. We ain't going to put no albums out. We're just going to go fucking on tour and collect all the money. Old school bands like Rush, they're going to put time and effort into making the album before they go on tour to give the fans that, that little extra something,
Yeah. And I'd actually like to get my hands the next thing that they released was the R40 box set in commemoration of their 40th anniversary in September of 2014. I don't know. Can you find
it? It's on Apple Music.
Oh, yeah.
Is it?
They're all on Apple Music.
I want to buy the record, though.
Of course I do.
I want to buy it. You have Mike. It's killer. Hmm. Well, after this, they kind of started slowing down much because, you know, the band was actually breaking down. Their health was breaking down at the time. You know, Alex had, you know, pretty bad arthritis, and Pert had tendonitis, obviously,
exactly,
from being a fucking banshee on the sticks for 40-something years.
And so that's kind of when they quit. For their professionalism, because they didn't really put that out there. They were so, like, quiet about it. And they... But Pert died. Professionally, like, no one really knew that they were on a decline, like, health wise, until it was.
Well, because yeah, they're private. I think. I mean, the
band should be. I don't really give a shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, like stop
about your
doing
Twitter
it.
Feed and your wife posing nude on Instagram.
Be a band.
Or whatever.
Be what you know? Everyone wants you to be. Like, I don't give a fuck if you're cooking waffles, whatever, or, you know, you're having a, it's just getting ridiculous.
Talking about waffles.
Hey, Mike.
I think it was cool that, you know, like, they kept it quiet for those, what was it, 3.5 years that Neil battled with brain cancer. Like, they didn't tell anyone. Like, they told them.
I'm surprised it didn't get out from the nursing staff and all that in the hospital stuff.
You know, like, you know, probably on point with that because, you know, they.
Yeah, I'll sue the fuck out of you.
Like, whoever they hired to keep all that quiet was on point, like on the level with them. And, you know, like, they kept it quiet. Like, they didn't want that personal business getting out. And, I mean, they kept it quiet for almost 4 years, and then he passed away and no one knew. Like.
Yeah, it was just.
Well, I also think that by this time, you know, because they pretty much quit, like we talked about.
They made that statement, they pretty much were done. We're not quitting.
At that point,
we're not disbanding, but we're no longer going to be touring. You might see some things in, you know, in the future, blah, blah, blah. Like, they kept it really professional. They did a really good job about it.
Right.
Mike, why don't you audition for the new part?
Shut your face.
Rush.
That ain't.
The new drummer, dude. You should, man.
Call Getty up. Call
you
Getty up.
This. Yeah. So you should call him. Call him immediately. Like, just as soon as we get off here, call Getty and tell him, I am the working man.
I'm not Canadian. I can fit in.
Yeah. So that took me by complete surprise.
Dude, you sent me the message.
Pure died at the
as into that shit as I am, I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And then you sent me a text message saying, hey, man, he passed away. And I'm like, what? You're kidding. Dude.
Yeah.
He was definitely one of the musicians. Like, where were you when Neil Peart died?
And I, like,
you know?
I mean, I'm biased because he's one of my favorite people of all time. Like, not just my favorite drummer, but he's also, you know, a cool, great person. And
a great person.
Smart. And, like, I read a lot of his things, his memoirs and stuff that he's written. But, like, when that dude passed,
intensely intelligent individual.
But, like, when a lot of other musicians pass away, I'm like, I'm not saying that in a bad term. Like, I don't feel anything. I'm like, you know, it sucks. It's a terrible thing. It's a tragedy. But...
Well, I mean, like, I always tell people, man, that there's, other than, like, sexual feeling and fear, music, to me, is one of the biggest attributors to emotional, you know, swing that there is out there. And when you connect to a musician on an emotional level, you know, not like anything to their person, but their music, you're attracted to their creativity. You know what I mean? Like, you're just drawn to that person. It'll hit you hard, you know, even though, like, when Chris Cornell died, you know, that hit me really fucking hard. And I was like, holy shit, you know, like, when you get emotionally attached to somebody's music, you know, that's a difficult
thing. When Joe Exotic passes away, I'm going to be upset.
Free Joe Exotic. Lock up that bitch, Carol Baskin. Yeah.
She fed her husband to the tigers.
Anyway, I think that's all we got this week on the old Rush. What a fucking episode, man. It feels good to be back in the studio and talk. I don't know. We'll see how many people actually listen to it. Well, we thank you guys for coming out. Sorry you're all on fucking quarantine. Your dicks look probably look like chewed up pencils by now. Pornhub's maxed out. Yeah, yeah. Go through you our past podcasts. Your hands. That's what you can do in your spare time. And and wash your fucking hands and don't spit in each other's mouths. And give us a check out on Facebook, obviously, Rock Isn't Dead podcast, as well as Instagram. And lastly, Mr. Willie Whitebread building guitars. So check out Whitebread Guitars on Instagram. You'll love them. You'll love them. Fully customized. You're going to love them. Everybody's going to love them. Anyway, we don't know what the topic is going to be for next week or the following 2 weeks. I want to thank Misfit Mike Martinez, not only for being a great person,
hey, we should do
for doing all of our audio.
Do a drummer's
editing,
thing.
But for being on the show. Sure, I'll just not talk. But anyway, we will see you guys next week. Thank you and stay healthy.